Establishing battlefield control.
So, hello, dear United Forum users. We are here with a special podcast today. So, with us are today Yeoman, aka Peter.
Hello.
Cola Colin. His real name is Colin.
Hello.
And I'm Freezy. My real name is Silvio. And we are here today with Chris Taylor, the RTS Pope, so to say.
Hello, hello. It's good to be here.
Cool. So, and we will talk a bit about Chris in person, what he was doing in the past, what he's currently doing maybe, and yeah, what are his thoughts about the gaming business and stuff like that. So let's start right with the beginnings of your career. Yeah, how did you end up in the game industry is my first question.
Well, you know, it's quite a story, and I love to talk about it. So I fear of boring everyone with the details. I'll try to move quickly through some of the early years of my life. I mean, I started off in the late 70s playing games in the arcade, and when I saw those games, they were just absolutely fascinating to me. I mean, all the electronics that were involved in them to make these graphics fly around on the screen. And it seemed like only people who had a lot of money could play these games. I spent every nickel or a quarter I had playing them, but it was very short, right? Your games didn't last very long. So when computers, when the Apple II, when the TRS-80s, and the Commodore PETs came on the scene in the late 70s and early 80s, this was the opportunity to have a computer in your home that you could play video games on. This is the beginning of PC gaming. And the games, quite honestly, were terrible compared to those games in the arcade. These arcade machines had dedicated hardware, they had sound chips, they had multiple microprocessors, tons of RAM, and they were very expensive. I mean, these machines were tens of thousands of dollars, and a home computer ran anywhere from $1,000 to $3,000. So of course, you know, to when you get one of these and you have all this these fantasies about these incredible games you're going to play, and then you get these really lousy graphics, it's a little sad. But honestly, we weren't sad at all. It was awesome. We still thought it was amazing to have this lousy version of Space Invaders or Defender or Stargate, if you remember any of those games, Pac-Man, all the classics were rebuilt for the home computer. And of course, as soon as I got my hands on a home computer in 1980, I immediately went to work at 14 years old writing the code to make my own games. I mean, this was a natural and logical thing. I got a computer, I'm going to write games. Now, at 14, of course, no education. Nobody who lives across the road who's going to teach me, no teacher at school knows anything about computer programming. This is all foreign. It was crazy. So it was an arduous process of learning how to first just get the machine to do basic things with the basic language, and then moving right away into assembly language programming to do things in Z80 or Z80, whichever you prefer, on my TRS-80. And that knowledge just built through my teens, and I got to do more and more stuff until I finally got my first job at 21. And when I walk into the job interview, I'm like, this is what I've been doing since I'm 14. This is what I've been making games at home. And they're like, okay, wow. So I got my first job basically because I had so much passion and so much energy and enthusiasm for gaming. I was really an unstoppable force. I tell people I could have punched my way through a concrete wall. There was just no stopping me. And that started my professional career. One, and that's, I got to work on Hardball 2, 4D Boxing, Triple Play Baseball. These were the EA years. Then I went down and I started a label, really. It was just a label. It was called Cave Dog Entertainment. And that label was inside of Humongous Entertainment. Humongous Entertainment was a children's software company, and they knew they couldn't put out a game called Total Annihilation So we created sub-brand called Cave Dog, and it was a playful brand. It was very sort of, it was meant that we could release strategy games, and we could release shooters, and we could release any kind of game we wanted under this Cave Dog brand. And that's where Total Annihilation was born. And that's a whole story unto itself. So I'll stop there, since that's the answer to your, at least to your initial question.
Yeah. Yes,
Yeah, can I ask a question about that? What was the first kind of game that you ever programmed? Not the first professional thing, but what was the first program you wrote where would you would say that was my first game?
I think it's I think I have to say it was a game called The Shopping Mall. And I grew up my parents divorced when I was 10 years old, so I hung out with my little brother at the shopping mall. That's where we went, that's where the arcade was. So I made this game in BASIC. It was an adventure game called The Shopping Mall, and you basically had to adventure your way around inside of it, just like the classic Zork, the classic Adventure International games by Scott Adams. Not to be confused with the other Scott Adams, but this was the these games were very popular. You had text, you'd get a description. We all know the advent. Remember the game? I think it was just called Adventure. They did it on the mainframe computers, like the PDP-8s, the mainframes, the minis. Well, you are standing next to a stream. Like this was all in text. So of course, this was still awesome, right? This was not a disappointing experience playing a text adventure. So I wrote a text adventure in BASIC, and it was short. You could play through it in probably 2 hours, but that was probably I'm going to say that was my first game.
And you finished that by 14, or?
That was when I was 14, yeah. And
Oh,
it was,
cool.
it took me probably, a week, because there's really nothing to it. I mean, very, very simple.
Okay, so I think we should move on to your major first title, Total Annihilation. What was different about Total Annihilation from other RTS games of the time, and specifically CNC? Because you said it was inspired by CNC one time ago.
Yes, and I think I oversimplify it for folks because it was inspired, but it was really the true inspiration was Dune 2. Now, what an interesting path of history, because the Dune the movie inspires the game Dune 1, which is not played by hardly anybody. Dune 2 comes along by Westwood Studios, which is feels like one of the first official PC RTS games that have been made. So credit to Westwood for doing that. And then I played Dune 2 and was absolutely convinced this was the future of PC game of PC action strategy games. We didn't have the title RTS then. We did not say, "Oh, this is an RTS." No. That came years later. So I knew that Westwood was working on a sequel of Command and Conquer, and I was working on Triple Play Baseball up in Canada at the time. And I was just waiting Command and Conquer to come out. So Command and Conquer is shown at E3, which was not E3, it was called it was the Vegas show.
A
Gosh,
PAX.
what's no, it was this is 500 years ago, remember. This is just after the birth of Christ. that this was all happening. I hope you guys have a se I hope you have a sense of humor because I do know that the birth of Christ was 2013 years ago. this was yeah. So it was at the big Vegas electronics show, consumer electronics show called CES. And I'm at CES, and I'm at the Virgin slash Westwood booth, I think it was at the time. And when I saw that, I knew that it was over for me at up at Distinctive, pardon me, up at Electronic Arts Canada. So I went back and I waited till the game came out. I played it. I resigned my job, and I called Shelley Day, who happened to be a producer on Hardball 2 when she was at Accolade. Now, this is some old U.S. publisher gamer history here, which probably will bore most people, but Accolade was founded by some ex-Activision people. Activision was founded by ex-Atari people. We're talking Atari in the days of the Atari 2600. I mean, we're talking about people who were hired by Nolan Bushnell himself. And so you've got this evolution of U.S. Publishers, right? You have Atari, you have Activision, then you have Accolade, which is like a PC-focused company, and you have Shelley working there, and you have me up in Canada doing my very first title called Hardball 2, and we get to know each other. Now Shelley moves on, and she goes to Taito. She then ends up at LucasArts, and she becomes friends with Ron Gilbert. Well, Shelley and Ron decide to go off and start this company called Humongous Entertainment. Well, that's when I called Shelley and said, hey, Shelley, I want to make a game like Command & Conquer. I want to do it in 3D. I want to have real physics. I want to have a lot more action, and I want emergent gameplay. I want less rules. I don't want to have so much contrived rules. I want tanks to shoot as far as their muzzle velocity will allow that projectile to fly with a particular gravity value. So I'm going to get really, you know, nerdy on this thing, right? Like I want this stuff to look good. I want it to feel good. And she said, well, I'm going to put you in touch with Ron Gilbert, who, of course, you know, is the creator of Monkey Island and famous for his work in at LucasArts. And he said, why don't you come down? Why don't you come down to Washington? This is the Pacific Northwest of the United States. Why don't you come down and join my company, Humongous, and we will work on this game and build this game? And I said, sounds great. So I came down, and I've been down here 18 years. I mean, that was the September-ish of 95. I came down in 96. Total Annihilation shipped in September, on September 4th of 1997. So you can see that it was a very quick, you know, things were moving pretty quick back then, and that's how the whole thing kind of started.
Cool. And yeah, and from the gameplay perspective, the physics-based gameplay made it so different.
Yeah, I can elaborate on that. I mean,
yeah, I know.
So here's something that was really interesting. Everything back then was like a 2D, and if you looked at Dune 2 and Command and Conquer, the units were pre-rendered 2D bitmaps, which means you couldn't have very many positions. You know, you had like they had to render all of the different like rotations, which took up a ton of memory. And even with all of those different rotations, the game still didn't look very good because it wasn't very smooth. We all know what 3D can do now. We're all educated. Here we are. I mean, we're nearly 20 years later. We kind of get it. We know that we know why 2D pre-rendered doesn't look good. But back then, this was all new territory. This was like, you know, this was a big deal to render something in 3D and have it hit whatever geometric angle was required because of the math. So that was really important to me. Trouble was, we didn't have 3D accelerated cards back then. So everything had to be done in the CPU, which means we call it rasterization. So when you had a unit on the screen, you had to rasterize it in 3D using the CPU, which was terribly slow. Now, how can you render a 3D terrain every frame, redrawing the screen, and then how could you redraw all these units on top of it? So what we did was we developed a system. We took a three-dimensional mesh of the terrain, we exported it into a program we called Bryce, we rendered a 2D bitmap across this 3D mesh, we rendered the 2D to the screen by keeping the camera at a fixed angle, no perspective, so this is an isometric projection, and then rendered the 3D units on top. But this still wasn't enough to give us the performance we needed on computers of the day, which I think were 100 megahertz computers. So what we did is we developed a system of caching a 3D rasterized unit into a 2D bitmap and caching these, because we realized that if you looked at the screen at any one time, a lot of stuff wasn't moving. And if it was moving, it didn't necessarily mean that it was rotating. It didn't necessarily mean it was going up a hill or down a hill. It was holding its current sort of position, so it was kind of gliding across the screen. So we actually we had an optimization that we could make, which was that stuff wasn't constantly changing. Even though it was moving, it wasn't changing. And this was really important. So this allowed us to build this incredible quasi 2D, 3D game that really, to most people staring at the screen, it looked like 3D game. And it looked good, the terrain looked good. I mean, back in the day, right? We're talking a long time ago here. But the fact is, it was really cheating. We were cheating using the tricks that, you know, you've probably heard over the years, right? Programmers like to use tricks to get these performance benefits. And that's exactly what we did. And I hope this is not boring anybody, because if it is, I'll do this kind of detail. But going forward, or you can just edit this, please just edit this out. But this is the heart and soul of game development, is to get the computer to do something that you shouldn't really be able to get it to do. And that's where all the fun comes from, really. That's where why we enjoy ourselves so much in this business.
I think that's still true today. But where's the fun in the future when we have machines that can do everything? Then there's no place for trickery anymore.
Well, it's interesting, right? Like we have graphics cards now that will push millions of polygons to the screen, and they've got gigabytes of memory, but there's still, the human mind is so huge and expansive. I think we will find ways to tap all that power. It may not make the games more fun. I think we have to realize that getting fun, in quotes, out of pure technical hardware advancements, like in the old days, like let me use an example. When we had 320 by 200 pixels on the screen, and then we went to, and we had 16 colors. Now, before that, we had black and white. And so we went through all the phases. We had black and white, monochrome. We ended up having, we had four color CGA, color graphics adapter, four colors, awful. We had 16 colors, then we went to 256 colors. We had 640 by 480. We had 16 colors and then 256, then true color, where we're talking 16 bits. And then, of course, now here we are, 32 bits, RGBA. Hey, we have all our dreams come true. Every time we advance through one of these technical barriers where we delivered higher and higher resolution graphics with more color, we saw a new experience on the screen. We were mesmerized by the sharpness of the graphics and the intensity of the colors, et cetera. And the games that were developed could effectively rely on the razzle dazzle of the tech. But that wasn't necessarily making the games more fun, but we didn't care. We were nerds, we loved it. We said, bring it on, more everything. Give us more CPU, give us more GPU, give us more color, graph, everything, resolution. And now we're at a really important place where games really just need to be fun. And the graphics are finally point where they are not main attraction at the show. You know, they are not the reason you go running across a Gamescom to stare at a screen. You don't, you go there to see the content. You go there to see the characters or the story or the gameplay. We've passed a very important point in gaming now, and it's actually good. I'm actually happy that we've passed this point. I left you speechless. Oh,
No, no, it's very
you didn't get warning that I like to talk? Oops, sorry about
interesting. I knew it because I watched some of the other podcasts. So, yeah. But let's move on. After TA, you created your own studio, Gaspard Games, and worked on Dungeon Siege. What was your incentive of doing that, creating the studio and doing a game like Dungeon Siege, which is pretty different from TA?
Well, when we were working on Total Annihilation and Diablo 1 came out, and I loved it. I absolutely loved it. And the thing is I had a I guess I had a crappy computer, because I was looking at the loading screen all the time in Diablo 1, and I would always go back and forth to town. I mean, this was a game where you found all the loot that you could, your inventory would fill up instantly, and then if you were a total OCD player, you had to go back to town and sell it. You couldn't leave it sitting on the ground and lose the value of it. So you're sort of trading time for gold, and those loading screens killed me. So I thought to myself, I build another game. I am going to make an RPG, an action RPG game, and I'm going to solve that problem. I'm going to have no loading screens, and I'm going to have a way to pack so much loot that I can concentrate on moving forward through the world instead of having to always go back. And that's effectively what Dungeon Siege, the core of Dungeon Siege design, came from. Now, in hindsight, the design fell apart, and as much as people may argue, or this is a split debate, but I think we automated the game too much. I think the game did too much for the player. There's actual gameplay fun in having to click on all the things in the world, and we had automatic loot pickup, we had automatic combat, we had automatic this, automatic that. Everything was too automated, and I think it hurt the experience a little. But you know, some people really enjoyed that. So it's a taste. It's really, you know, it's up to each person what they like. But that was one of the criticisms I would make of that game. But it came out of that Diablo experience where I felt like I was doing too much. So I wanted to try a game where the computer would do the mundane things for me. So that's kind of where that design sprouted from.
Mm, cool. And what was your incentive of creating your own studio?
Well, it goes back to when I started at Distinctive Software back in Burnaby when I was 21. I wasn't in control. I mean, quite honestly, you know, you walk into a place, someone decides, you know, what games the studio is working on and what you're going to do. And I didn't want to have my career managed by someone else. I wanted to be completely in charge of my own games. And I wanted to decide what I built and who I hired. And I didn't want some manager guy that was looking over my shoulder. Now, when you start your own studio, it's not all roses and sunshine, because you actually trade a bunch of those negatives for a bunch of other negatives, which is now you have to manage payroll, pay rent, put together all the employee benefits, and you have to hire people and deal with people that leave, and you've got all the other grief that comes along with starting your own company. But I didn't know all that. I just thought, oh, I'll get to work on what I want, and it was. I still think it was a good decision. We ran Gas Powered Games for 15 years, and it was a good 15 years. There was ups and downs. There was some painful stuff. You know all about the painful stuff, I'm sure. You've seen the pain. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was. I feel like, you know, it was like the 15th round in a boxing match. I was beat pretty hard. And it was time to give that a break at the end of 15 years. But going in, oh, I was ready for the fight. I was full of piss and vinegar, as we like to say. And I don't know where that saying came from, but I think it described me. I was ready to take on the world back when I started GPG.
Okay. What I wanted to ask you is, out of the games you've made with GPG or back from Cave Dog or even way earlier in your career, what is the genre of games you prefer the most to make?
Well, this is actually kind of a weakness of mine. I do love RTS, but I love other genres. I love all kinds of games. So, you know, it's sort of, imagine, if you will, how terrible it would be to make only one kind of game your entire life. Like, we see an analogy to Hollywood directors. They don't just make action movies their whole career. They go off and they make other movies. Now, those other movies can flop. People could say, you know, when Steven Spielberg, for example, went off and made The Color Purple, it was a great movie, but it wasn't like Jaws or E.T. or Close Encounters or Saving Private Ryan. It wasn't one of those big, epic Hollywood movies. It was kind of an art piece. It was kind of his going off and doing something different. So the world doesn't reward you economically for going off and doing things that are kind of art pieces or something that sort of stretches your creative a little bit. So for me, my core is RTS. I wouldn't make another action RPG at this point. And the reason why, and of course now I'll be proven wrong and I'll end up making an action RPG. That always happens to me. But the reason why is because it's too much damn work. Okay, it just takes too long. There's too many things to manage. It's I've been there already. I've hiked that mountain. You know, I've climbed that mountain. You know, the thing about RTS though is that I just love the whole concept, and it's just so fun to have these armies smashing together. And you know, I was playing around with ideas with Kings and Castles, and now, of course, the news of Total Annihilation. That's super exciting. So I have to pick RTS. However, if you were like making me sign a piece of paper and saying, Chris, love RTS, so sign right here and you'll only ever make RTS the rest of your life, I can't sign that, because I don't want to be locked into making one kind of game. In fact, I have ideas for the future, like maybe in the next 10 or 20 years, where I'm going to be doing games that are unlike any game that I've ever made before, and any games that have been made. Brand new games, games that are truly painting something different on the canvas, that doesn't fit a genre, that doesn't fit an established, essentially an established genre. And that's, I think that's important for creative people.
Yeah, so maybe you will be the guy who creates a new genre, like they did with Dota, and which is now a MOBA game.
Exactly.
So, yeah. Your next big hit was Supreme Commander, and did you feel that you had unfinished business with Total Annihilation, or why did you create the game?
Yeah, there's definitely some unfinished business, because I left Cave Dog, and it wasn't the best of circumstances. I sort of told a story, you know, I talked about how, I always wanted to start my own company, blah, blah, blah. Like, you don't want to put your dirty laundry out there in front of the world. Now, I can tell you, there was dirty laundry there. There was a bit of a disagreement with me and the company that I wanted to go and, you know, I had, you know, I won't actually tell you what the dirty laundry is, but I will say that there was a sadness. Because I wanted to do TA2, and there it was just sort of I knew I couldn't just go make TA2 with my own company, because in those days, you know, there was a possibility of some legal stuff happening where someone says, hey, did you take this, did you do this, you know, so you don't want to really go there. And I felt that it needed to take a break. I needed to just step away, and I needed to leave that alone for a while and go do something else. And that's where Dungeon Siege came from. It came from that let some time pass. But when Supreme Commander, we sat down to begin on Supreme Commander, and that title was originally, as you know, with maybe you don't know, it's documented. It was originally with Electronic Arts. And we were, this was a chance to do so many things, exciting things. Strategic zoom, the whole zoom in and zoom out. The dual monitor support. More units than you've ever seen before. Going from two factions to three factions. So you had this really crazy triangle of strength and weaknesses. We had an opportunity, of course, we did, to kind of look at the economy system and to tweak it and to make it a little easier to use. The commander unit, which was a big part of Total Annihilation and Supreme Commander, obviously, was taken to the next level. Experimental units were taken to the next level. The Fat Boy, if you remember, you got a giant mobile tank that goes under the water, has an airport on the roof, is a factory, shits out units. I mean, this stuff was crazy. And it really was scratching an itch that we had building up in us from the T, you know, by missing out on that TA2 opportunity.
The transition from Supreme Commander 1 to Supreme Commander 2, when you announced the economy system of Supreme Commander 2, you said that the nerd in me died a little bit, and is there a chance that maybe in the future that nerd will come back to life?
Well, that nerd probably won't come back to life on Supreme Commander, because of course that IP is no longer owned by me, Gaspar Games, or it's now Square Enix's property. So they're going to have to decide whether that nerd comes back to life. But insofar as other RTS properties that I am capable of working on, and I think you know what I'm talking about, I don't even need to be coy, I think that nerd is alive and well.
I'm glad to hear that.
I'm glad we're speaking in colorful metaphor.
Yeah, cool.
It's perfect. The nerd is like Superman. He's got a red cape. He's powerful. He's punching through walls. The nerd is alive.
That's good, because during your White Man campaign, you said something like that the old Chris is dead, but now he's alive again, you say.
Yeah, I think if you could see me now, sitting here, I'm full of life. I'm very happy. I'm excited. I'm working inside of a fantastic company, Wargaming. This company is exciting, innovative. It's taking on... It's charging forward. It's breaking the old conventions and delivering exciting games. I mean, legendary games worldwide. We're just this is frankly the one of the greatest changes in my life, let alone my career. And it's not very often that happens. I would say the last time I had this experience was when I left Electronic Arts Canada 18 years ago, and I moved down to the U.S. That was probably the last time that I did something as exciting and as big as this. And I think you can probably feel it and hear it in my voice, that it really does. It gives you back years of your life. You know, you'll lose years of your life on some things, you can gain those years back. So not all is lost. Yeah.
That's good insight, yeah.
Yes, it sounds great. I would like to ask another question about Supreme Commander. If you had to choose today between making a Supreme Commander 1, which was targeted to a more core or even hardcore audience, or a Supreme Commander 2, which at least... in the view of the more hardcore fans, went casual, so to speak. What would you prefer today to do, and or do you think there's maybe a third way which would please both audiences, but also having the risk to fail the expectations of both?
Okay, so in I think it's clear to everybody that there was... we made some changes in Supreme Commander 2 where it felt more casual, because we had to go to a smaller map size, and we fixed that. We released a larger map, but of course there aren't a lot. There was a couple of things with the tech tree. I really like the tech tree. I like the research, but I think people felt that it was too confining or something. I'm not sure. I don't have a definitive answer. But if I had to pick, if you put a gun to my head and said you better pick, you know, I'm going to go back to Forged Alliance. And then I'm going to go forward from Forged Alliance kind of into your third choice, which is to take Forged Alliance, bring in the flow field pathfinding, bring in the clumping system, the attack paint system, and all the innovations we did in the UI that were really freaking awesome innovations. I mean, if you go back and play Supreme Commander 2 and play with some of those incredible unit selection UI innovations, those are awesome. You can't deny it. We did fiddle with the economy, and that's the thing is, we did that because people couldn't understand the economy, and we saw that we might be able to break out to a larger audience if we could make that economy more accessible. And the truth is, that was a mistake. But despite having tweaked it and fixed this and tweaked that, it we never got people's faith back. We sort of lost them, even though we fixed a lot of it with patches and updates. We did a lot of work, and you know, these were creative choices. These were not choices motivated by money or motivated by you know, some sort of business element. These were pure creative design choices that we made, thinking that we were making the game better. And you know, if you juxtapose a boxed game with an online free-to-play style game, you could fix those things in a free-to-play online game. You could just keep patching them, and you could work with the community, and it's a live experience. So if you make a mistake, you can fix it. But unfortunately, with the boxed model, with the sort of, you know, fire and forget, you know, you do something, patch it a few times, it's very difficult to continue to massage and work the clay. You know, there's so many approval processes. and red tape and testing and expense that you kind of get into this. Well, that's our thing. You know, it's like the paint dries and you know, you gotta love it. Although we did do a lot of work, it just felt like, you know, if people had come over to Supreme Commander 2 and given it a chance, you know, which I think some people eventually did. They would see that we could release bigger maps, we could do a lot of work. But once you lose your momentum in sort of what we think of as the old PC business, you're kind of done. You know, you've had your swing at the ball, and now you've got to move on.
Okay, let's talk about Demigod a bit, because that's the small intermezzo you did between XCOM 1 and XCOM 2, and it was quite well received for its gameplay. It was the first commercial mobile game, but some people say it flopped because of network problems. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, there was a lot of discussions at the time around the networking, and man, we worked with Stardock to get that whole problem solved, and I thought we did so. But here's the real issue. It was an there's a real architectural problem. See, in the old days, we had no server, we had no backend server solution. Everything was peer to peer. And if you follow PC gaming history, you know that if I'm at my house and you're at your house and we need to find a connection to each other, we can do that. And it's pretty reliable. Now we had a third person, and now we have to have three lines of connection. Now we add a fourth person, and then it goes up to I forget what the actual formula is, but you can imagine it in your mind, you know, the square with the X that goes between. So four, five, six connections with four people, then you go to five people. It goes up in this way. Eventually, when you try to get up to 8 versus 8, or you know, even 4 versus 4, you get up into this geometric projection progression of so many connections, you really need a server that handles. So everybody talks to the server, just like you do with an MMO, and the server talks to each person. So we were seeing this problem, and we really ultimately needed a dedicated server to run the whole thing. And the game was done kind of on a smaller scale. It was sort of experimental. It didn't have a single player campaign. We weren't spending tens of millions of dollars. It was that we spent a very conservative amount of money. And so we were really not in a position to go and build a dedicated server backend. I mean, that's an expensive proposition. And when we did kind of work all the details out of getting the connections, the connectivity problem mostly ironed out due to this, it's almost an unsolvable problem when at a certain number, like because somebody somewhere is not going to get a connection to one of the other people in the other, you know what I mean? Like somewhere somebody's not going to connect through to one of the other guys, and you have to have, not only do you have to have everybody connecting with each other, they have to sustain that connection for the whole period of time that you're playing, which could be 45 minutes. So if one person drops out or one thing screws up, you know, your game experience is compromised. So very difficult problem. Certainly, you know, wished we could have done a whole bunch of things differently, but it was another chapter in the learning and the tough in the school of hard knocks. Do you have that saying? There were some hard knocks in there, but you know, like anything, you just have to push forward and learn and do better next time.
Yeah, that's true. Okay, so yeah, your next big project was Kings and Castles, a fantasy RTS, but which was put on hold because you did not find a publisher to fund it. Can you tell us why no one was interested?
Well, and that's not in that. Let me correct that bit of history. We did find a publisher.
Okay.
We did find a publisher, but it was not anywhere near final. Like when you are an independent developer and you find a publisher and they are super excited or interested, that does not put money in your bank. Does not mean you can start writing checks. It means that you have a process in front of you of negotiation and of discussions and you know, of back and forth over fine print. We were in the processes of just getting that going with a publisher who was interested, and Microsoft knocked on our door and said, "We're working, you know, my Age of Empires Online. We'd like you to help us out with that." And I said to the team, I said, okay, I had a partner down the street We've worked before with them. They have a really incredible game here that we all love. We love Age of Empires. My favorite of that series was Age 2. I said, do we want to risk going out of business, or do we want to go with a sure bet and work on a really exciting game and make sure that we can get through this tough economy? Because the economy was so, it was kicking everybody's ass. I mean, if you guys remember, starting in 2007, the fact that we were just clinging, you know, insurance after 9/11, insurance rates alone were going through the roof every year, so that the cost of running a business was just becoming ridiculous. And you know, we never missed a payroll in 15 years, I'm proud to say, but I had to make a very, very tough decision. Do I go with basically the bird in the hand? If you hear more sayings, the bird in the hand, or potentially a bird or two, a bird in the bush, and a creative bird, like the fact that we'd be able to exercise our creativity more with Kings and Castles. Kings and Castles wasn't going to be a cheap game. You have its characters. When you're dealing with equipment, tanks, helicopters, so on, you know jet fighters, you tend to have, it's a less expensive product to make because you have the art content doesn't need to be animated and so forth. So Kings and Castles was going to be a pretty expensive title to make, and we were going to have to probably make it on a really tiny budget. So it was going to mean some real tough times. And possibly failure. Or we could work on something like Age of Empires Online with a partner we worked with in the past, and, you know, really get through the storm and do something cool. So that was the decision from a pure business standpoint. And I stand by that decision today. I still think it was the right way to go.
Okay. But your video blogs, which you did for the Kings and Castles, were very well received, and I think they were hilarious and a must-see for persons who are interested how games are created. And do you think that they were a great idea too, and do you plan to do something like that for your next title again?
Yeah, the video blogs were a blast. Now, putting one out every single week, that was a lot of work. But it was great on a bunch in so many ways, and we were just starting to get into it. I mean, the beginning of a game is kind of boring. I mean, you're really doing a lot of work with documentation. But we had some pretty good, I thought we had some pretty good blogs. I was a little bit crazy on the blogs because I thought nobody wants to watch a boring guy walk around the office going, hey, what are you doing? What's happening here? And so I tried to have fun with it. It's kind of closer to my personality, frankly, than not. In other words, there wasn't a lot of acting going on. So the blogs were awesome. I loved them. But if you look at the numbers, honestly, if you go to YouTube, you look at the views, the numbers were going down. I mean, we were in the 15,000. I think we were lower than that. Shit, I think we were down at 4,000 or 5,000. Think about the world today. Think about the number of people that are playing the big games. Millions and millions of people play, you know, whatever, X, Y, Z, right? We had 4,562 people, I mean, you know, watching a blog. I mean, that's not enough penetration. Those were the most ardent fans, if you will. Those were the people who were the most passionate, and I loved every one of them. But that wasn't enough to support the economics, to convince me that the economics were going to really work in our favor. It's kind of like voting with your dollars. Instead, it was voting with your views. And I think the publishers, quite honestly, saw that. Can you imagine if the first video blog was 50,000, like it was, and the second blog was 75,000, and the third blog had 100,000? We would have had publishers lined up down the street, their checkbooks ready, to say, we will pay you whatever it costs. We have to have this game. You're up to 500,000, you know, viewers a week. You know, this is exciting. Woo! But it wasn't. It went the other direction. There was a diminishing interest, if you will. It measured the enthusiasm, and the enthusiasm, though inspiring on one level, wasn't enough to sustain it. And that's sad. That's really sad, because it was a damn fun thing to do.
That's true. But you did some blogs for Age of Empires Online. So were they better received?
No, I don't think they were actually. This is like the this is. Let me ask you something. Does the world really want honesty though on these podcasts? Because the thing was is that we were trying to bring some of that corny, zany, off the cuff sort of Benny Hill. You know, somebody said, what was it? The cable guy. We were trying to bring some of that to this process, and people weren't that interested in that. They really just wanted to know what were the new civilizations, what were the units, what were the stats. I mean, they're no fooling around. They wanted just the data. So our blogs, if you remember, went from being sort of some corny slapstick, Saturday Night Live or whatever, into this hardcore, like, here's the facts. Here's just what you're getting. And I think we got more response ultimately. I haven't looked at the numbers in the last year or so, but I think it just turned out that that fan base, if you want to say, those customers wanted data. They didn't want comedy.
But I want comedy. I want to see.
Well, you and five other guys wanted comedy.
Yeah, but when I'm watching those things, I really wonder why you did not become a comedian, really. Because you're really good at that stuff, I think.
Oh man, it's so nice of you to say. You know what? I really appreciate that. But the truth is, the world is cruel. Have you ever seen like America's Got Talent or one of those talent TV shows? They probably have them in every country of the world in every language, right? Where people get up on stage and they sing their heart out or they perform or whatever, and the guys and the judges, they just go, "Sorry, you're just not talented. You just suck." And there's someone in the audience who says, "No, I love them." Unfortunately, I think that might be you. That's yelling from the audience saying, "I
Yeah.
love the way he can ride a unicycle and juggle." But the truth is, the judges said no. The judges said, "Taylor, you're not funny. You're not a comedian. You're charming on some level, maybe. Maybe you have some public speaking skills." They were there. There's sort of a kind of a higher than average love for sort of the honesty that I portray, but comedy is not it. And so I will not be showing up at the local comedy club anytime soon.
Okay, so coming to serious topics again, Age of Empires Online was stopped in January, and can you give us some insight about that, maybe?
I think again, it's a situation where people voted with their dollars. I don't think the sales were there. Ultimately, I didn't have access to that data. The decision comes from Microsoft, their publishing group, in their games, in the games group there, and they made a decision based on the economics. And it was sad. We were really disappointed in it. But it, like anything, the old saying: if you've ever been fired from a job, and you go to a friend and say, "I was fired," and they say, "Yes, but one door closes, two doors open." And this is really what happened. I mean, we had a door close on us, but we had many doors open. One of those doors was the fantastic door that we walked through. And now, as part of Wargaming, we would not be here today talking to you, and I would not be talking about the fact that I'm not, pumping off the Space Needle, depressed. But well, actually, that wouldn't be true either because they don't let you climb over the top of the observation deck. The point is, though, is that I'm here today and I'm in a great place because Age of Empires Online was canceled. So you just sometimes it's your fate. You just take it as one day at a time, take it as it comes, and it turns out everything worked out really well. So I'm happy. I'm thrilled with the way things went.
Okay, but yeah, the other door you tried to take was the Wideman door, and Can you talk about the Wildman campaign a bit?
Well, the Wildman door was locked, or it was a door, but you know, you open it and there's a cliff on the other side of the door, right? Like in a movie where you kind of hang on the door handle and one leg kind of wobbles out there, and there's like a pit of lava. That was a really tough door, but damn it, we tried. We tried. I threw everything I had at that. I called friends. And people basically voted again. The Cruel World, our talent show of a reality that we're live in, which was, no, Chris, we don't want to mix action RPG with RTS and maybe a little shake of MOBA. We don't want it. Make us another RTS game. Make us another RPG game. But don't mix the genres. We're not interested. And I accept that. That's fair. You just have to accept the fact that people had an opportunity to register, if you will, a vote on a game before it was made. How often do people get a chance to do that before Kickstarter? Not very often. You know, they find out about a game when it's at alpha, when it's at beta, when it's going to a trade show event, when they hear about it in a magazine, and it's already been made. Someone has already spent millions, potentially, or at least hundreds of thousands, or years of their life in this game. I mean, and so the customer basically gets to decide, am I going to buy it or not? Well, on Kickstarter, they get to choose, is it going to get made or not? Is it going to get made or not? And in this case, they said, no, don't make it. We don't want to play that. And I said, okay, then I'm shutting the company down. That was what happened. And it turned out that in the end, things went differently. But it was a pretty clear process, you know, of here's what I want to make. Do you want to see it made? Okay, no, you don't. Okay, see you later. I got to go now. So it's easy to laugh. It's easy to laugh now, but boy, oh boy, was that tough at the time. That was really tough.
Oh, yeah. You said this whole process changed you in person somehow and opened your eyes. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, well, it means that I stopped thinking that the fans of one game would automatically become the fans of another game. No, people are fans of one game. They are maybe fans of another game. They may take a look at another game where they might not have, i.e. brand. The brand extends like an umbrella, but it doesn't mean, you know, if you like Campbell's chicken noodle soup, I don't know if you have Campbell's soup, but in America, you know, Campbell's chicken noodle soup is kind of like the chicken noodle soup we grew up on in the 70s and 80s. It was the go-to soup. It doesn't mean you're going to like the mushroom soup. The mushroom soup might be fantastic. It might be wonderful, but it doesn't mean you're going to like, if you don't like mushrooms, you're not going anywhere near that mushroom soup. And, you know, when you think about fans, you've got to give them respect for that. You've got to say, yes, you like Dungeon Siege. I have people that divorced over Dungeon Siege. They got divorced. There are people that said they played the theme, the soundtrack, every night before they went to bed. Their wives had to sleep in other rooms because they couldn't stand the soundtrack playing. just think about how ridiculous that is. Okay, so their personal lives are being torn apart over their love of your game, and then you say, "Did you like Total Annihilation?" And they say, "No, I hated that." So you know, so it doesn't transfer. That sort of thing doesn't just transfer around. You cannot take people for granted just because they like Total Annihilation or like Dungeon Siege or like Supreme Commander. Doesn't mean they're going to like Wildman. Doesn't mean they're going to like Kings and Castles. You're starting brand new with everything you create and to get people to like it and to come on board with it. And it's like a politician where every vote counts, where you have to go kiss every baby and you have to shake every hand. You have to do all that work in the streets to build that fan base, that loyalty back up. You can't just snap your fingers and say, look, everybody, I'm doing this. Are you on board? You know? And they go, and unfortunately they say, no, we're not. And you're like, oh, okay, sorry. I guess I'm not going to be doing that then. You know, you have to earn it. You have to earn their respect and their vote, and earn their vote, so to speak.
That's true.
Okay, to come back to the Wildman Kickstarter, you showed off a browser-based modding tool you called Project Mercury while doing the Kickstarter. And while the Wildman Kickstarter itself was a door with a cliff behind it, as you say, maybe Project Mercury is a door that is not as closed?
Yeah, I think that was true. And I think it was a very exciting possibility. Like, the problem is, when you run a business and you've had 120 people in it, you have a giant office space, you have a lot of overhead. And so what we were seeing there was a little tiny doorway. It meant that I needed a little tiny office. I needed 2,500 square feet. I needed a team of six people, not 30, gosh, at the time it was, I think we had closer to 45 or 50 people. That became an economics problem, a business problem. And I was out of runway. You know, like you have an airplane. It's a perfectly good airplane. The engines are running, whatever. But you just ran out of runway. And you need to stop the airplane, turn it around, and go back in the other direction and take off, which would have been saying, we couldn't take off with Wildman, but we could take off with Project Mercury. Not enough runway. Not enough time, not enough money, all of the economics of where we were sitting in the business basically were preventing us from being able to restructure in that time. So we were just out of options. You know, well, actually that's not fair. We had options. We were just out of the time and money to exercise those options.
Okay, so Project Mercury will not continue, or will you get it out in some years?
Well, I sold the company and all of the things inside of it. So that's a decision going forward in the future. But I at this point now, I think we've got some other things we're focusing on, and so that's probably not going to be something you hear about anytime soon. No, I would guess.
Okay, speaking of selling your company, what was your experience during that, and how's your experience now with Wargaming, and how is it different from other companies? And yeah,
well, it was great. I mean, you have to go through a period where you deal with a lot of lawyers, okay, and that's not fun. That's not what you think of as fun. Going to Disneyland is fun. Talking to lawyers is not fun, right? But you do it. It's kind of more like, let me use a better analogy. It's like going to the dentist, because you get all the drilling and you can smell the smoke of your teeth if you've ever had some bad cavities like I have. You're like, this is awful, but I need to do it. It's a process you have to go through. It gets done. It has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And once you're finished, you're good, you know, and you're ready to go. And that's where we're at. And I feel really good about it. I don't want to do it again. I don't want to start another company and sell another company. Some people like to do that. They think that's like the entrepreneur's like whole, like that's their trick, right? Start a company, flip it, make some money, go on. Not me. I am super happy. I'm content. I don't want to go through that process and paperwork of signing leases and creating, you know, employee benefits and doing all of the things that you have to do. I mean, I'm just choosing random examples. I mean, jeeps, there's 200 things on the list of to starting a company, from banking and legal and accounting and tax law, and that's all behind me now. And what's great about that is I get to focus on the creative. So like when I'm not on this call with you, I'm reviewing creative. I'm looking at game design documents. I'm talking to game designers. I'm effectively the creative director here. So that means I get to oversee and look at what's happening creatively inside the company, not on the phone to a publisher saying, can you pay us for that milestone we submitted? Because by the way, that was 3 weeks ago and you had 10 days to approve it and you're overdue now. And what's going on? Like, you in 15 years, I could tell you every story about me. Basically, it's like you're not only an independent game developer, you're a collections department. You know, like in the movies where the guy's on the phone trying to collect, you know, from all the people who owe. It's really ugly. It's not really that. It's terrible what you spend your time doing when you're an independent developer and you're the owner of the company, you're running the business. But so that's all gone away. So I get to focus pretty much 100% of my time on games and creative, and jeepers, that's like, you know, that's nirvana. Think about it.
I think that's good news for all gamers.
It's not to say that people shouldn't go and start their own company if that's what they want to do. I'm not trying to discourage entrepreneurism. I'm not trying to discourage those guys who have those dreams. But I did it. It's like I'm coming down from climbing Mount Everest, you know, and I'm like, okay, whoo, that was good. Thank you very much. And people are on their way up the mountain. I'm like, hey, go knock 'em dead. Have fun. Enjoy it, you know. Maybe you'll have you maybe you'll enjoy it more than me, or you won't enjoy it, or maybe you won't make it. It doesn't really matter. That's their destiny, and that's what they should go do. So I just want to make it clear that and no way do I want to discourage people from doing that.
Okay, and in relation to Wargaming Net and the TAIP, I know you can't talk about future projects and stuff like that, but I have another question about that, and it's can you tell us about the chance of the source code of Total Annihilation being released in the future?
That I have no idea. That's an interesting question, though. You know what? Anything's possible.
Okay, to another topic. Can you elaborate about the state of the games industry as a whole, very short? What do you think about the current trends and like free to play and something like that? And do you think that there's still a chance for RTSs to be made? And yeah, what are your thoughts in general?
Oh man, well, you know, I was on a panel at PAX and someone says, "What do you think's in store for the future?" And I said, "You know what? I used to think I could predict. But now I think I'm you know the old saying, sometimes you know you think you know it's oh, what is it? You don't know what you don't know." And you have to think about that one for a bit, and you go, yeah, of course, you don't know what you don't know. Like, you don't even know what to go look for. You don't even know where to look. Well, I used to think that I knew what I th used to think I knew this industry, that I thought, oh, well, it's going to go in this direction and this direction. And, you know, the big city games like the Grand Theft Auto 5, I mean, we kind of knew that was going to happen, right? Someone's going to model an entire city. The people are all walking up and down the sidewalk. I mean, that'll grow. That'll continue, right? They're going to go into the buildings. You'll be able to go into an apartment building, go up to the certain floor, and burst into their apartment, whatever, and you know, do things, whatever you want to do, you know, like it'll be this living city, and you'll be able to run around like you do in the streets. But in other areas like this, like the Oculus VR, I mean, that sort of came out of nowhere. We all thought VR was going to be here years ago. It had a lot of false starts. People are thinking that this could be it, but it may or may not stick. It may or may not go mainstream. We just don't know. This business is unpredictable. Who could have predicted Zynga? Who could have predicted free to play? You know, who could have predicted? I mean, and we're not talking about it existing. We're talking about the success. And then, of course, we see some of the things that shoot up like a rocket and then dive down and crash. And we are just as surprised to see them go up as we are to see them go down. Although not always. This business is pretty damn unpredictable, and if you think about it, the one of the easiest areas to predict is the technology side of it. There's a lot of graphs you can draw, right? We know we're going to get more polygons, we're going to get more RAM, we're going to get more cores. We know 4, 8, 16, 32. That's easy. But when it comes to what tickles the masses, you know, the fact that we've seen tablet gaming kind of come out of nowhere, the iOS and then the Android, and people are saying, oh yeah, you know, it's all about mobile gaming. Mobile, mobile, mobile. I mean, Candy Crush, Clash of Clans, Puzzles and Dragons. I mean, these things are blowing our minds. We're seeing 100 million gamers grow to 500 million, grow to 1 billion gamers. I mean, we might be at 2 billion people playing games here in the next 10 or 20 years. So I think at this point, I think it's best to say we don't know. But whatever it is, it'll surprise us, and it'll be exciting, and it'll be great to be a part of the business when it happens.
Yes. Okay. Imagine you have a total, basically real-life sandbox where you have an unlimited budget, unlimited resources. Your audience has basically unlimited processing power on their computers, and you had as much time as you would ever like to have. What is a project you would totally dream of creating if you had a total sandbox situation?
Wow. Well, that's a fun question. You know, that's a question I would have liked when I was 21, 25, 30. But now I'm at a point where I don't think the answer is with unlimited. So, okay, so you hand me the checkbook. You say, Chris, you can write a check as big as you want. You can hire as many people as you want. I'm not even going to scratch your checkbook. You're going to be a little disappointed because I'm not going to go after the biggest, because the biggest isn't best. It's not about that to me. It's about creating something new. Like if I gave you a word processor, a blank word processor, I want you to write the next great life-changing novel since the Bible, okay, or whatever. Since you know, what – every country probably has something different, but you know, like, you know, when J.K. Rowling sat down to write the Harry Potter series, she didn't need an unlimited amount of money. She didn't need an unlimited amount of paper or an unlimited amount of CPU processing power on her word processor. She just needed her creativity. And this is where I think gaming is going. So if you're my banker and you're telling me, Chris, I love you, man, and you can have as much money and as much time as you want, I'm going to say to you, you know what? I'm going to focus on creative. I will spend a little of your money. I will hire a talented team, and I will build something original and new, and you're going to be pleased, and you're going to get a good return on your investment. I'm not going to have to spend, you know, $400 million like James Cameron's next, you know, movie. I'm not going to have to do that to deliver the game that will scratch my creative itch, if that makes sense.
Okay. Yes. Minutes ago, you hinted at the TAIP, and now you say original games and creative things are the best thing to do. But how does it come together? So will your next project be probably some original stuff? And yeah, can you tell us about your dreams, so to say?
Well, I can't, I won't, I shouldn't. It's just not an area that I'm ready to talk about yet, but you can use your imagination, even though you're not on the project. You are welcome to use your imagination. Your imagination will serve you well, I think, in this case. Does that make sense?
Okay.
Probably, no.
It makes sense. Yeah, I want to thank you for coming at our show and talk us and entertain us, of course. It was really mind-opening, and thanks very much.
Yes, thank you.
Yes, thanks very much.
My pleasure. So once you guys stop... okay, sorry, we're on the air still.
Do we have any last things to say?
You know, that's a good question. So I've always got something to say. asking me if I have something to say is kind of rhetorical, isn't it? I do want to thank all the folks that frankly have listened to this hour. You're a great bunch. You've got hearts of gold to listen to all of what I had to say there. And thanks for your past support over the years through the Wild Man Kickstarter. And I really hope we have something exciting for you cooking here, and you'll enjoy that. And that's it. So it's really about being very thankful for being able to do what I do. And I consider myself one of the luckiest people alive on the planet. Especially lucky because I survived this last year, but the last 25 years has been just blessed right from the beginning for me. So I appreciate it very much.
Okay, cool. So we will be thrilled to see your next game. And let's end this now. Goodbye, and thank you, everyone.